So as we start off tonight, I have a question. I would love to hear your guys' response to it. First of all, show of hands, how many of you would consider yourself a fairly idealistic person? You're kind of an idealist. Okay, a few of those hands shot up. How many of you tend to be pessimists? Raise your hand. All right, yeah, like the idealist hands like flew up. The pessimist hands were like, why are you asking? What is this? Is this a trap? I tend to be an idealist. That's the side that's probably not a surprise to anyone who knows me. I tend to lean on the idealist side. I will say this, the older I get, the more like a realistic approach to that idealism kind of is setting in. I would actually say I would label myself lately more of a realistic idealist. I believe in big things. I believe in potential. I believe there could be like hope and all that. I also am realistic about the fact that it probably won't happen in its fullness tomorrow because over time you just kind of get beaten down by the gap between your idealism and reality and you have to learn how to wade through it a little bit. And I think this is especially true when it comes to relationships. It is so easy to idealize relationships, right? It's so easy to think about the idea of love or the idea of marriage or the idea of friendship, the idea of family. We love those words. Those are wonderful words until you try to do them. And then it becomes so much harder. So romantic relationships, I feel like on Facebook in the last 2 days, I've seen like 5 different people get engaged. And it's beautiful, it's wonderful. I love these people a lot. But like the picture is so perfect and the sun's setting and she's beaming. And I'm like, okay, that's great. And I'm excited for you, but it's gonna get real soon. Maybe I'm more of a pessimist than I let on. It's like, I mean, we're like Luke and Angelica, who we had up here on stage a few weeks ago, talking about how they're going to go to the Philippines and all the great stuff they're going to do. I got to be at their wedding yesterday. Beautiful wedding. Amazing wedding. But they are about to, within a week of getting married, move to the Philippines and do ministry over there. The idealistic beauty of it is going to hit a very, still beautiful, but a really tough reality really soon. And for some of you, you found that to be true, is that like you love the idea of relationships, you love the idea of dating, you love the idea of being in a lifelong commitment with someone, and then you step into it and you're like, well, why aren't you perfect? And the idea, you were perfect and you never challenged me at all. And it turns out it doesn't work that way so much. And friendships. For those of you who are on the younger end of our community and you're kind of like moving out of college into adulthood, did friendships get so much harder? Because in college, it's easy. Because you all kind of live in the same place, you're doing the same thing, you're a part of the same club, and you're like, we're gonna be BFFs forever, and you take pictures, and you have all of you in the picture, and it's great, and you're like, we are gonna be together forever, and then you, like, college ends, and you go into life, and some of you move away, but a lot of you stay around the same area, and then people get engaged and get married, and that disrupts the friend group. And you find that you don't have as much in common anymore because like this person went and did this career and that person's going and doing that career and the schedules don't match up at all. And the next thing you know, this friend group that was such an idealistic, cool thing has become very, very hard reality. For some of you, it's like family. We love the idea of us being with our family and it being great. And sometimes because we love that idea so much, we make really dumb decisions like, no, it'll be great to do a cross-country road trip with my entire family. And your friend's like, are you sure that's a good idea? You're like, it's gonna be great. It'll be such a chance for us to bond. And you come back, you're like, I made a horrible mistake. I never should have done that. What was I thinking? It's so easy to get caught up in the idea of relationships, the idealistic vision of what they are. The reality becomes so much harder because the reality is this: human connection is difficult. And there's just no way around that. The ideal allows us to paint a picture, but the reality is so much harder. And I say that tonight because it's easy for us to talk about community here. I've already done it tonight. And to make it sound like this wonderful idealistic thing of like we're all the family and we're worshiping to being together and the baby dedications and all of that. And we talk about community and being the community in such idealistic terms sometimes that I think sometimes we skip past the part that it's really hard. And so for some of you here tonight, every once in a while I'll meet someone and they've been coming here for a year, 2 years, and they don't know anyone else in this room. And every single week, some of you have been showing up and you feel alone here. For some of you, you've been burned. Maybe it's by another church, maybe it's by people here, but like you allowed yourself to get close in a church setting and it went south, and now there's this part of you, it's like, no thank you, I've seen community, I'm fine where I am. For some of you, you carry, and I would identify this way, you carry a lot of wounds and brokenness in your life because you were taught at an early age or somewhere along the line that people weren't safe, that if they saw the real you, they would reject you. And so you kind of live in sort of a faux community where you're around people, and maybe you even know, maybe you could like be the person who knows more names of people in this room tonight than anyone else. But if you were to ask who really knows you, I mean really knows you, that list would be almost non-existent. And there's some of you who are here tonight and you're not followers of Jesus, you don't do this Christian thing, you're just checking it out. And you kind of, let's just call it what it is, you came here tonight kind of thinking that Christians suck a little bit. It's like, and that's okay, we know. We see the Christians that are out there saying things on TV too, we get it. And you came here tonight and you're like, I don't think I wanna be a part of like a community of Christians at all because they're really hyper-judgmental and weird and you just don't want anything to do with that. And my point is this, is that when we talk about community in a church setting, it's easy to be idealistic about it, but the reality is so much harder. And so tonight, we're going to look at a passage that on its surface seems to be very idealistic, but then we're going to dig beneath the surface a little bit, and we're going to ask the question, how is it possible for us to be in community together? So the verse we're going to be looking at is in Acts 4. We're going to have that up on the screen. It's also in your notes. If you're a note taker, you can go ahead and grab your bulletins out. This is Acts 4, verse 32, and it says this. All the believers were united in heart and mind, and they felt that what they owned was not their own, so they shared everything they had. The apostles testified powerfully to the resurrection of the Lord Jesus, and God's great blessing was upon them all. There were no needy people among them, because those who owned land or houses would sell them and bring the money to the apostles to give to those in need. Now that's an exciting vision of what the church could be. And college Josh would read stuff like this, and he'd be all like, man, the church today is too institutionalized, man. It's like, it's gotten corporate. We need to go back to how the church was back then. We just need to meet in houses and do all this stuff. I was like super idealistic about it. And then I went and worked at a church. And I discovered the fact that like that reality, that whole idealistic reality gets really, really tough. And here's what I would say. Sometimes that makes us feel like we're missing out on something because we read stuff like this in the Bible and they're like, well, why isn't it like that now? Let's keep reading two more verses from this one. Like, because that chapter kind of goes a couple more verses and it cuts off. Allow me to continue into chapter 5. And we'll have this up on the screen. But there was a certain man named Ananias who, with his wife Sapphira, sold some property. So far, so good. He brought part of the money to the apostles, claiming it was the full amount. With his wife's consent, he kept the rest. Now, Ananias saw himself an opportunity here. He's like, oh, it looks really good when you say that you like sold a bunch of you sold something and gave all the money to people. So I have an opportunity here to look really awesome around all these other church people while still holding back some of the money for myself. That's a win-win. And immediately, the church gets all screwed up. Two verses later, and if you read the rest of the story, it gets kind of gnarly and it gets really messy. It's like immediately introduced into the church at its core is a lot of dysfunction. And so we had this idealistic vision and dream for a little bit, about two verses, and then it all went south. And just in case you were wondering, like, well, that's just one story. Allow me to run you through a few of the other things that happened in the New Testament or that were said. One of the biggest conflicts throughout the New Testament church was whether non-Jewish people could accept the message of Christ or if they had to convert to Judaism first. So that today would kind of be like telling someone, oh no, anyone can become a Christian, but you also have to become an American too. And so early on, there's this weird nationalistic, ethnic, like division that's happening right out of the gate in the church. Some people think the entire book of Romans, all like 16 chapters of it, is a giant treatise from the Apostle Paul, this guy who started all these churches, basically saying why all the Jewish and non-Jewish people had to get along because they were all the same. That guy, Paul, he went around with a guy named Barnabas, and they would plant churches all over the Roman Empire until they got in such a bad fight that they couldn't keep hanging out anymore because they just couldn't be around each other, so they split off and went their separate ways. 1 Corinthians, Paul has to tell people, stop dividing yourself based on which Christian celebrity you follow. Some people were saying, no, 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 I follow Paul and his teachings, and these other guys are like, there's this guy named Apollos, which is a much cooler name, and so I follow him. And so they were dividing over Christian celebrities and whose theology they were behind. A good thing that never happens today. 1 Corinthians 5, Paul actually has to write a letter saying, stop sleeping with your father's wife. First Corinthians 11, stop suing each other. You are in court suing each other so often, you are making the church look bad to people who aren't Christians. Also in 1 Corinthians 11, hey, rich people, stop showing up with all the food and alcohol, eating everything you want, getting drunk while there are poor people at the church service who are starving. In a letter to Philippi, Paul again has to write to two women and tell them, hey, that fight you're having, yeah, I heard about it all the way over here. Could you stop it? Like, don't do that anymore because you're leaders in the church and that's causing problems. The church and community all throughout the New Testament is incredibly messy. Just incredibly broken and messy. And my point is this. It's never been easy. Community has never been easy. The church, figuring out how to be the church together, has never been easy. So why am I telling you this? Because somehow in the middle of that mess, that huge mess, Christianity expanded like wildfire, and in 300 years had become so dominant that the emperor of the Roman Empire declared it the official religion of Rome. So my point being in that in 300 years, something happened in the middle of this messy, broken community full of screwed up people doing screwed up things. Somehow the church thrived in the middle of all of that. And in the middle of all of that, the writers of the New Testament keep casting this compelling vision of what could be. And so we end up with verses like this in 1 John 4, where the writer John says this. God showed how much he loved us by sending his one and only son into the world so we might have eternal life through him. And this is real love. Not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins. Dear friends, since God loved us that much, we surely ought to love one another. No one has ever seen God, but if we love each other, God lives in us and his love is brought to full expression in us. I want to read that part again. No one has ever seen God, but if we love each other, God lives in us and his love is brought to full expression in us. Let's leave that up on the screen for a second. That's about as idealistic as it gets. That's some Les Mis, to love another person is to see in the face of God, cheesy but awesome sort of stuff. Like, this is the height of idealism. I got like five people smiling and a bunch of people like, I don't know what that is. Scratch Les Mis references from now on. Good to know. This is an incredibly idealistic thing that the writer John is calling people to. How, and here's the question. Here's what I'm curious about. How is it possible that the writer John, knowing the church, knowing the dysfunction, knowing who these people are, knowing their problems, writing a book where like 12 different times he tells people, love one another, love one another. You don't say that 12 different times if the people are already doing it. How is it then that in all of this, he's able to believe in such an idealistic picture? Here's my thought. I think it's because God's power moves in the messy reality of love, not the pleasant ideal of it. that God's power moves in the messy reality of love, not the idealistic version. What do I mean by that? So I talk a lot about my family, my wife, my kid, and I was thinking about this, and I was like, I've got to find other illustrations, but I just kept coming back and thinking about marriage in this. So when I look back, Christina and I have been married a little bit over 4 years now, and when I look back on our marriage, there are some beautiful, idealistic moments, some big stuff and some small stuff. There's like those small little moments where she wants to go to sleep, and I just keep pestering her, which probably wouldn't be what she would describe as one of her favorite moments, but it makes me feel bonded and connected. There's those small little things where we're just making each other laugh about completely ridiculous, stupid stuff that wouldn't be funny to anyone but us. There's those moments where you can just sit in silence and enjoy the same thing together. It's good stuff. And then there's some big stuff, right? Matter of fact, I have a picture I took, an Instagram picture, and this is a picture that will show up on the screen of our trip to Florence, Italy. And when you look at that, I mean, that's the sun setting over this river. And it's like, I know it's Instagram, and yeah, it's filtered up a little bit, but to be honest with you, it felt a lot like that. That describes the emotion I had when I was there. And like, I was thinking about that trip, because that trip for me, I don't know if Christina would say this or not, when I think about our marriage, that trip for me is like a highlight of like one of the best, most amazing things that we experienced together as a couple. But you know what's interesting? You know what I wouldn't say about that trip? I wouldn't say that that moment right there has necessarily had this super profound impact on the character of who I am right now. I mean, it was great. It's a good memory. But I wouldn't say that's like this character-forming thing that has made me a better person than I am. You know what's done that in our marriage? It's been the hard stuff. And Caleb's 14 months old now. And the first year of Caleb's life was easily the hardest year of our marriage, probably the hardest year of our life, I think we both would say. There were times where we just felt at the end of ourselves, like we had no answers, like we're supposed to love this child, but he won't stop crying. It's like, what do you do with that? It's like normally things in life have some sort of like cause and effect, and he's just like, nope, I'm doing it. And you just get to this point where you're like out of answers and you feel like you're failing as a parent, you're doing it all wrong, and you just are broken, and you feel like everyone else gets it better than you. And then you kind of turn, that insecurity turns you at each other. And so much in the last year, I'm being as honest as I can, in the last year, so much ugliness has come out of me toward my wife, so much brokenness, because as I've been insecure in trying to raise Caleb, as we've been trying to figure out how to be parents together, as I feel like I'm failing at being a dad, which means, and then I'm trying to like love Christina, but I can't even do that well, so I feel like I'm failing at being a husband, all of my failure stuff comes up, and I start feeling really insecure, and I feel like if people could really see the real me, so I start pulling away, but then all of the ugliness in me just starts seeping out, and like I start becoming really sarcastic and bitter, and I start hurting my wife's feelings even when I know I shouldn't, and I do it anyway. And I'll be honest with you guys, it's that struggle that is shaping who I am right now. Because a year later, I'm a more loving and kind person than I was a year ago. Now, that is all relative. But the character that is being formed in me was not formed on some bridge in Florence. It was formed as my wife and I figured out what it meant to stay in community together, to love each other well when we had nothing left to offer. And honestly, it was formed when in those moments, we separately and together cried out to God and said, we can't do this anymore. We don't have it. We are not loving. I am not loving. I am not good enough. I'm not capable enough. I don't have this love that I'm supposed to have. Because God's power moves in the messy reality of love, not in the ideal. So why am I saying that? Well, I just talked about my junk. Let's talk about yours for a second. I mean, can we be honest here? By and large, when it comes to the idea of being in a community that gets to the point of being uncomfortable, that's not something a lot of us are willing to sign up for. This is a very LA thing, right? We're very like surface level polite. Oh, no worries, man. It's like, no worries that you were 15 hours late to that thing. We said to me, no worries. And then we go and we like complain about it to someone else. Can you believe that person did it to me? We form communities that operate around a general idealism, a general pleasantness, where we all sort of like the same thing or enjoy going to the same places or generally laugh at the same jokes. But then the moment push comes to shove and you really have to tell that person, you hurt my feelings when you did that, or I'm sorry, I was wrong. When we have to call someone out and say, hey, I see this thing that you're doing, and you know I love you to death, but I don't think that's best for you, and to have the possibility they might get really mad at you in that conversation. When it comes to the idea of our communities being so real that they get uncomfortable, where we move from the ideal of like, we're all friends, to the point where you say, this just got real, we're not willing to make that jump. And because of that, and I just want to be honest with you, if we continue to decide to stay in our comfort zones in our community, our church will never be the powerful force of God that it is meant to be. It won't. Because how could we ever possibly choose to go outside of our comfort zones to tell people who don't know Jesus that God loves them and has a plan for them, even though it might make them weirded out and might make them want to reject us? How are we ever going to do that if we're not willing to even become uncomfortable with people that we're close to? How are we ever going to be appealing whatsoever to someone who's not a follower of Jesus if they come here and just see the same crap that they see everywhere else? If we do not have something to offer in our communities that is better than what is happening out there, then what's the point? It just means that they have to come here, listen to a bunch of people sing some songs, listen to a guy like me rant and rave and sweat for a little while. And it's like, I could be watching like Sunday Night Football. That feels so much better. Unless we have something to offer that shows that there is a God working in our midst, transforming us, changing us, moving past ethnic boundaries, moving past surface differences, moving past our desire to stay comfortable above all else, unless we are able to model a community in which we get uncomfortable and fight and apologize and come before God in all of that, if we are not capable of doing that and being that, why would anyone else want to be a part of our community? And so tonight, and I know it's hard. I know it's hard. I hate vulnerability. I hate people getting too close. I'm scared of being hurt. I get it. I really do get it. But tonight, if we are going to be a church that is whatsoever relevant to the 30,000 18 to 35-year-olds that are 10,000 feet from this room, then we have to move past the ideal of community and allow God's power to move in the messy reality. So how do we do that? Let's break this down. Practically, how do we get there? The answer is not going to be surprising to those of you who have been coming and hanging out with us here for a while. The answer is this: join a life group. Now here's the deal. There might be some of you who, we've talked about this so many times, and you're like, nope, not gonna do it. And the reason is, you're like, because that sounds really uncomfortable and weird. Well, that's my setup tonight. It's uncomfortable and weird. Yeah, now, like a marriage, is it sometimes great? Will you have moments where you're like, oh, I remember that time when we had that incredible night where that person shared that thing, we all rallied around and prayed for them? Sure. Like, you might go on vacations with some of these people, you might do, like you'll have moments that you'll share together that will be beautiful and amazing and idealistic, and what we would put on, like, some sort of image on our website of, like, what an ideal life group is, and you will experience that moment. But that moment will happen surrounded on both sides by weirdness. Because when people get into the same room and decide to try to be honest together, the stuff comes up. Now, first of all, let me tell you what a life group is. If you're here and you're like, oh, life group, what does that mean? A life group, we have people who once a week meet in houses all over the city of Los Angeles. They meet to talk about God, read the Bible, pray together, be in community together. It's a place both for people who are checking out faith and people who are passionately committed to their faith. It's a place where we move to the honest, more honest, and most honest versions of our story. So when I say join a life group, I also am going to give two outs. There are two groups of people here tonight who don't have to join life groups. If you're here and you're checking out faith and you're not a follower of Jesus, congratulations. You do not have to join a life group. Now, I think that could be a great thing if you want to. I think that could be a great place for you to like hear Christians talk about this whole thing and to be honest about where you're at and for them to accept you in that. For some of you, you might be more comfortable checking out faith in that kind of place rather than coming to like a church service because that still feels weird. You're like, what do I wear? You know, it's like, it's a home and it's chill. But you have an out. You don't have to. Also, here's another group of people who have an out and who don't have to join a life group. If you are in an intentional group of followers of Jesus and you meet regularly, talk about the Bible, pray for each other, challenge each other, do life together, then you are excused from being in a life group. If you have that in your life currently and those things are happening and you're intentional about it, then you don't have to be in a life group. The rest of you, if you do not figure out a way to get in an intentional community that pushes you past your comfort zones into something more real, then you will miss out on the best that God has, not just for you, but for us. You will miss out on journeying into the messy reality where character transformation really happens. And so, maybe you're thinking, okay, great, join a life group. How do I actually do that? Or like, maybe that's like gonna be your thing. Like, well, I don't really know how, and he didn't say, so I'm just not gonna do it. So we have a couple screenshots that I'd like to show you. We'll have the first one up here on the screen right now. So if you go to our website, this is cafusion.com, you will see a spot on our life groups tab where it says join a group or lead a group. Choose your own adventure there. If you'd like to lead a group, you click on that one. If you'd like to join a group, you'll click on this one. Now, you might be wondering, well, what happens then? I'm glad you asked. So you'll click on that, and it's gonna take you to this page. Now, this page is gonna have every life group that is available in the life of Fusion on there. You can scroll through them. You have different ways to sort so that you can find a group that fits you. The truth is, we have a lot of different groups that look a lot of different ways for a lot of different kinds of people because we, Fusion, are an 18 to 35-year-old community. 18-year-old and 35-year-old's a little bit different. And so we've acknowledged the fact that it might be helpful for us to have a few different kinds of groups. And so you'll have to go on our website to see all the different kinds of groups we have. But we thought that it would be great to just have you meet a few of our life group leaders. So I've actually asked them to kind of come up to the stage. So if we asked you to come up, you guys could come up to the stage right now. If the rest of you could give them a hand. All right, well, welcome. So first of all, if you guys could share your names, we'll just start with you guys and then we'll get to you in a second.
Okay, right. My name's Megan.
And I'm Maddie.
Megan and Maddie, and how long have you, has your life group been in existence?
Our life group has been in existence 2 whole weeks.
Wow.
Yes.
Has it been a solid 2 weeks so far?
Yeah, it's been pretty great, yeah.
Okay, that's fantastic. All right, and so describe a little bit of what your life group is. Just tell us about, how would you describe it?
Yeah, we're just a pretty calm group of ladies. We meet on Thursday nights and we gather and just kind of hang out and talk life for a little bit. We're actually starting a talk going through the Gospel of Mark. So it's kind of just like a chance for us to talk through that, ask questions, kind of like delve into what this means for our lives. It's a really cool chance for us just to hang out and eat food and get to know each other. So it's been really fun.
Yeah, you nailed it. All right, and then Mark, how about you slide down here? I'm over here. And are you in their life group as well?
They didn't let me.
Oh, so. That's fair. Okay. Okay, so Mark, you and then David are just now, I mean, your life group hasn't even started yet, is that right?
Yeah, we're like negative 6 weeks.
Here, great. So. Awesome. Negative 6 weeks. And tell me a little bit about what you guys are doing, because I've heard you talk about it before. It's really awesome.
Yeah, so David and I are both freelancers. David is not here, as you can tell, but he will be next week. David's an animator and voice actor. Cool, I know. And I'm a photographer. And a while ago, we started like engaging with the idea of what it means to be a freelancer slash like creative type slash you don't really know how to describe it and be a Christian. And so we're just starting a group that's kind of engaging with that idea and trying to figure out how to be faithful in that and also just be honest with each other when business is slow or when clients suck or, you know, whenever.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, awesome. All right. And so both of your guys' groups are up on that page, right? And so if someone, and then also if you see them kind of hanging out, they'll be at the cafe afterwards. I'm just going to say you will be. I haven't asked you, but you will. Then you can just find them, ask them more about their group if you want. Guys, thank you so much for being here. I appreciate it. And so if you are wanting to join a life group, the goal of what, or if you're willing to, our goal tonight has been to make that as easy as possible. But the reality is this, we also know that there's a lot of you here who are already in a life group. And so maybe even for some of you sensing that maybe I was gonna go toward like the join a life group thing, you're like, well, this talk's not for me. Let's talk about what that means if you're already in a life group really quick. There's a quote, I think I've used this this quote before. It's a quote by a writer named Kurt Vonnegut, and he said this, "The most daring thing to do with your life is to create stable communities in which the terrible disease of loneliness can be cured." The most daring thing to do with your life is to create stable communities in which the terrible disease of loneliness can be cured. I read that quote at this point to say this. It's not just about being in a group. It's about having the boldness in that group to push past the surface stuff, to push past the formalities, and honestly to push through the fear of what if they really knew, what if they really saw, what would they do if? It's a daring thing to be in community. It's not easy. And so my challenge for you, if you're a life group leader or you're in a life group, here's my challenge for you. I said this before, to work on bringing the honest, more honest, and most honest of your versions of your story. To start with the honest one. Yeah, I'm doing all right. More honest. To be honest, I've had a hard week. Most honest. My girlfriend just broke up with me and I'm not taking it well. As a life group, to create space where it's safe for people to give the most honest version of their stories, to lean in, to allow the messy reality to create space for God's power to bring hope and healing and redemption. I want to go back to the first part of that passage from 1 John 4 that we looked at. God showed how much he loved us by sending his one and only son into the world so that we might have eternal life through him. This is real love, not that we loved God, but that he loved us and sent his son as a sacrifice to take away our sins. If you're here tonight and you're checking out who we are and you're trying to figure out what this God thing is all about, I want you to hear that this is what it is. We're a community of people who know that we're broken and flawed and screwed up, and if you get to know us, we'll probably say or do something dumb at some point, because we're all broken, just like you are. We're all broken. But we have found hope and healing and redemption in the person of Jesus. We both found that, and then we are finding that. We're both living that and trying to figure out how to live it. It's both a reality, and it's something that we're moving toward. And so what if, for those of you who are a part of our community, what if you created space in your life for the messiness to release God's power and to do a work in you? What if a year from now you could say that you are a better person, that your character has been changed, not because it was easy, not because you didn't do stuff that was like hurtful that you had to apologize for, but because that stuff happened, that you created space for God to move and to create stronger version of your character, and then you also had relationships that had been through the fire, tested, and stronger because of it? And what if we as a community of people learning to build strong, authentic communities then brought that safe place to a world around us desperately searching for the cure to loneliness? What if it was possible through Jesus' power for that to happen?